Off. I am Dave Bennett. I am an aging Jesus freak who happens to be part of the PCA, which sometimes I'm apologetic in saying that. Go ahead and pass it back this way, too. I've been a part of the PCA in the West since the middle 80s and was fortunate to be part of actually four different church plants over the last 30 years. 10 years ago, and this is kind of a weird story, if I were to be honest, I've always had a passion for working in an at-risk context. So for the first 15, 20 minutes, we're going to talk about CCD principles. And if you're not exposed to CCDA, then this is the opportunity for the PCA to be more proactive in promoting an amazing mindset that's kingdom driven and very much in the PCA, but not necessarily promote it. And so 10 years ago, I had restarted a church plant that had gone south, and as the church starts growing and going places, I am a 60s rock and roller, biochem degree, philosophy degree, MDiv, and I don't usually say this often, from Westminster Seminary, West. And so the path I pursued was not one of being hyper-reformed or theologically driven, but that's what became of the church I was planning. And so my goal in my church was to be mercy-driven and being somewhat idealistic, capable of ministering both to whites, African-Americans, and Hispanics in a context that was an affluent neighborhood. That didn't work. And so my three elders at some point decided they didn't want me as pastor anymore, so they actually asked me to leave. And I was somewhat frustrated, mad, to be honest, because the church had just bought land, we're going to build a building. And there's a part of ego involved with this. But the real point of the story is I had been involved with Habitat for Humanity for the 10 years I'd been with the church. And that was my real passion. The church was kind of second seat to that. And most of my people in the church were 30-somethings that were more my age bracket. And they loved what we were doing, but the leadership didn't. So the clash happened. I left. And then over 6 months or so, really sensed God's call not to move on and plant another church, but to stay in Phoenix. I'd already been there a decade plus. I already had connections through different cities, new city council, which in the past I'd never have done that. And then had a sense that God wanted me to do an at-risk type of ministry. And so my parents were from St. Louis, Missouri, New City Fellowship in St. Louis. I really hadn't been around very much, but chose to visit, hang out, got to know Barry and Aaron Henning, who are great guys, and a few of the key staff. And then came to a point where I said, okay, God, you know, if you want me to do this, you've got to provide the means for it to happen. One of the difficulties in doing at-risk work, different from a church that has members that have normal incomes, is I work in a low-income, no-income neighborhood, which means you don't have normal churches. Most of the churches in my neighborhood, the pastors are bivocational. That's just a fact of life. And so one of the decisions I made was to step out in faith and see if God would raise the means for me to do the work that he obviously had set up for me to do. So as I talk about CCD principles, this comes back to something which is very risky. Very few Christians want to move into an at-risk neighborhood. And so what God called me to do was move from a very nice suburb house, which my kids loved, into a neighborhood that was still a nice house, but into a neighborhood that wasn't white. It was predominantly Hispanic and African-American. And so as I prayed through this, I'm the type of person that dives in first and then kind of plans and thinks about things later. And there's good and bad with that. And so as I share my story of New City, or if you speak Spanish, Barrionuevo, this very much is who I am now. My passion is to see, and I'll talk about what we do in a few minutes, seeing people connect with God, which is a common thread, but the way in which it happens in my neighborhood very much is multiracial. And so one of my prayers for the PCA is to see, you know, I love the fact that you're an attorney and that you're African-American. Same thing with you, brother. But in my neighborhood, you know, I'm the oddball. I'm the minority. And so the difficulty, you know, I love what you shared, but the reality in my neighborhoods for the PCA churches which are around me, they're not going to reach out to that neighborhood unless I invite them. So last week, one of the things we do, which is a byproduct of my Habitat background, is paying houses of low-income families, which are basically seniors, primarily African-American grandmas. So last week we had 150 volunteers come from five different churches, a law firm, pagan law firm, and from Grand Canyon University, which is supposedly a Christian institution, kind of, and also from ASU. And we painted 5 houses, all of African-American grandmas. I think the average age was around 80-ish. And took 2 hours or so. Took 2 weeks worth of work to set the houses up in order to do that. And so the process of doing that leads me into my CCD discussion. Right. So if you were in your typical suburb church, the likelihood of somebody that lives in Scottsdale, which would be a very affluent community in Greater Phoenix, to drive into my neighborhood is zero. Unless you're going to a couple of restaurants or to a park where you can go mountain biking. So the likelihood of having believers come and hang out and meet people and decide to be a part of a tutoring program, after school program, or mentor a kid is zero. And so what God's placed the burden in my heart is to be a bridge between different communities, to see the kingdom principles, and this is where I get in trouble sometimes, are different from Reformed theology to some extent. Grace is the most awesome gift God has given to us. How we live that out, though, determines what actually happens in an incarnational context. So one of the questions I ask when I give presentations, whether it's small groups or big groups, is as you look at your life right now, is it your fault that somebody's in prison? Is it your fault that some kid tonight won't have food on his table? Is it your responsibility to provide not just financial assistance, but more so fathering, mentoring? The community I live in, which is probably 45% Hispanic, 25% African American, and the whites that live in my neighborhood, maybe that's 20%. Most of the kids I work with, which are about 100, don't have dads. So one of the calls God's given to me is to pursue people to become a dad, to become a mom, to become a big brother, big sister, ultimately. But the fact is, most Christians don't believe they have any responsibility to stand up and become an advocate. As we talk about racism for a few minutes, classism, these are things which most in America today would say have been erased, right? Right? No? Okay. So as a Christian, this is the real question. Do I have any moral, spiritual obligation to address racism in my home church? Question. So do you? So how do you do that? It's a battle. I get into fights all the time with my PCA friends, and I have probably 6 or 7 non-PCA churches that support me financially and volunteers primarily. And the two questions I'll be asked when I make a presentation, is it safe where you live? And how do you respond to that? Well, if you come out at 2 o'clock in the morning, no, it's not safe. If you come in the daytime, no, it is safe. Other question will be often, what about immigration? You know, what about issue of, I live in a gang neighborhood. When I first moved in the neighborhood a decade ago, the City Council of Phoenix and the Phoenix Police Department put together a program called Take Back the Neighborhood. Because the year before, there were, this is not D.C., but there were 62 homicides in my bigger neighborhood. And so they found a up-and-coming superstar in the police department, Lieutenant Michael Kirkenbach, who's now a commander, who came up with a template that could be used anywhere in the U.S. to understand how you combat racism. Because where I live, nobody wants to call the police because the assumption is if a white police officer comes to a black family's house, what's going to happen? Yeah, no, obviously. Obviously, you know, I get into fights all the time with some of my, I have about 20 college students that are interns from GCU and ASU, and quite a few are African American. So I get into a discussion, why is it the assumption black, you know, guys are guilty? Why is it the assumption that white police officers are going to shoot? That seems to be what's happened significantly. And so CCD principles would come back to John Perkins would be the grandpa of this movement. And so I'm not going to go through this. There are some books on the back table. He's written a lot of books which are excellent. But pretty much he comes back to the fact that he uses biblical principles to talk about God's heart for the poor. And if you read the New Testament and Old Testament, there are over 4,000 plus citations about God's love for the poor, for the alien, for the widow. So I'm not going to go back and read Matthew 25. Chris already did that. But ultimately, my goal is not to give somebody a guilt trip, but more so to motivate them to see that the kingdom and the gospel that Christ has brought to us is about spiritual reconciliation, but also racial reconciliation. And so one of my pet peeves, even today, tomorrow, and yesterday, is I haven't heard that term yet. And I would hope that it would come out of somebody's mouth. The fact that we have to be about, you know, human reconciliation, which means racial reconciliation, and classism, ultimately. Skip to this next one. Perkins, if you were to read, he's got two or three books which pretty much unfold principles which are common amongst all people groups. Obviously, as you relate back to the culture that you live in, if you're going to bring the gospel, relationship becomes the key path to seeing life transformation. So everything I do is very intensive with spending time with people. And so people are all looking to belong to something. And until you belong to something, you feel like you are an alien. And it doesn't matter what race you have, what social economic background you have. I'm around a lot of wealthy people who give a little bit. They could give more. But most engineers don't have the gift of socialization. You know, I talk to some guys who are great friends, been involved with church with me for like 20 years, and they look up like this most of the time. Next thing, which again is common, you know, I work with a bunch of African-American teenage guys, and their dream is not to become an attorney, not to become a scientist or a police officer, but it's to become a NBA superstar. So they do want to be significant in life. Work with a lot of girls, young teens and 20-somethings. They need security. The one thing in life which is missing, which is huge, there's no dad. Without a dad, you don't have that sense of safety net. You don't have that sense of ultimately knowing someone's got your back, which is sad. Real focus, quick like, is Perkins' three R's. And unfortunately, when I chose this color, I didn't know this room would be this way. Maybe do me a favor, turn the light off in the back. This might make it easier. If you read any of Perkins' books, he'll say his three R's in different ways, but this would be the gospel from a CCD perspective, that if you're going to have any impact in the ministry God's called you to be involved with, whether that's local missions or foreign missions, you have to physically live in, I don't like the word target area, but in the community in which God's called you to bring the truth, the gospel. The challenge is we don't want to do that. We would much rather stay in our comfortable suburb homes. And so for me, it meant that I moved from a nice neighborhood to a less nice neighborhood, still a nice house. But the difference, though, is that as you look at Jesus' paradigm for ministry, he, different from us, we expect people to come to our churches, but Jesus chose to go to the people that he called to be his followers. And so living amongst, and the word poor I don't like, but living in a marginalized, under-resourced neighborhood is almost a requirement if you're going to have any impact in an at-risk community, which is God's call in my life. Next, he talks about reconciliation, both vertically and horizontally, between the Father and between your family, your friends. And one of the difficulties with misconception, misunderstanding of poverty is we assume it's just about money, it's just about resources, but ultimately it's about brokenness that's a byproduct of your relationship with God, relationship with your family, and your relationship with your friends. Touchy topic, and Perkins is funny, he says redistribution, but it just comes back to resources. Churches don't want to give typically to outside causes that deal with people and circumstances which are not a part of their ministry, which I understand. But at some point, somebody in the kingdom of God has to choose to give of themselves, give of their gifts, and give of their treasures for communities that have been forgotten and left behind to see gospel restoration take place. So this would be, again, if you went to a CCDA conference, Christian Community Development Association conference, this would be like the basics being talked about. So if you're in a church that has a passion for a neighborhood that's relatively close by, half an hour or less, and you want to be a part of that neighborhood in a real way, you have to discover what the real needs are. And so one of the sins of Anglo PCA teaching elders who are mostly engineers and affluent is I assume, I'm talking about myself, that I know what your needs are. So I don't have to ask you. I'm just going to come in and fix you and say, here are three things you can do. It takes some work. It's all biblically based. And in 6 months or less, your life will be, you know, rocking. And the reality is that doesn't work. Doesn't work in a white community, doesn't work in a black community, doesn't work in a Hispanic community or an Asian community. And so some way you have to find out what's really going on in the neighborhood or community that you want to be a part of. Again, this is not rocket science. What did Jesus do? He walked. He listened, he observed, and he interacted. And so ABCD, which I didn't go into detail with this, but some are very hip on what would be called asset-based community development, which means, and this makes sense, I work with a lot of grandmas, so one of the first things I did was ask one of my spiritual grandmas, Mrs. Jefferson, you know, what's the biggest need in the community? If I were to do one or two things, what would you want from me? And it was obvious. Youth need help. And you could have a list of things that would go on that would take most of your time. The second one was herself. You know, I'm a senior. Her husband had been a pastor. He's in heaven. And she would say, I feel like I've been forgotten, left behind. She has generations of kids she's helped raise. And sad to say, none of them are really following Jesus. And so she needed help. And so we painted her house. She's like the fifth house out of 120 now. And a month later, she had a stroke and ended up paralyzed on one side. Her speech was very difficult to understand. But over time, she's improved. But her 2 cents to me would be to be an encourager to me to say, keep loving on the kids in the neighborhood and then loving on seniors. So what's happened for me, which I'll share in a few minutes, is seeing God's pathway to most at-risk communities coming back to the youth. If tomorrow's going to be better, we had better do something different tomorrow than yesterday if kids are going to grow up to become teens. And in my neighborhood, to graduate from high school is huge. 2 years ago, I had a close friend, African-American guy, who just graduated from Harvard with a master's, who's now a CNN analyst, who'd been the only black reporter at the Arizona Republic for 8 years. And so he chose to do a story on the youth disconnect in the African-American community in Phoenix. And I was kind of surprised as I heard this from another friend. And so as we talked, I said, well, I've got a teenage guy, we'll talk about him more in a few minutes, who you should get to know and use him as the face of the article. Statistics are important, but in the end, what gets people is when you see someone and you meet them, then you're willing to walk with them and learn. And so back to the principles, which are so important, is that unless somebody understands a person's story and are somewhat convicted but yet also drawn in to help, nothing becomes different. And so in an at-risk context, there are churches, but most of the churches which I'm around are small churches which are afraid of outsiders for real reasons. And so in your packet I've handed out, there's a sheet that talks about what we just talked about, a sheet that talks about at-risk youth as being a pathway to neighborhood revitalization. Let me just throw out a couple questions and we'll walk through this. How many of you have lived in new neighborhoods where the house you were in was brand new? Anybody? Okay. So what is it like to be in a new neighborhood? Good? Bad? What happens when it comes to making friends, making, you know, difficult? Yeah. So how about your experience?
I don't know. I mean, what do you say?
Okay, so compare living in an old neighborhood versus living in a newer neighborhood.
I mean, relationally, there wasn't really a difference in my experience.
So put yourself in a different context where you're a grandma who's lived there 50 years, which is the case with most of my grandmas. I've been around for almost 10 years, lived in the same house. Most of the houses now that are new have front porches.
No.
You get into your house by doing what? Going into the garage door shuts. Do you see anybody outside ever?
No.
You live in your house, you live in your backyard. Older neighborhoods where I live are different. Everybody's outside in the front yard, sitting on chairs, enjoying. In Phoenix, this is about right now until March or April actually. And so people live outside all the time. And so revitalization, though, in the terms of the gospel, isn't just about, see if I can say this without getting myself in trouble, it is about a couple things. One is seeing people become more aware of their spiritual needs. One is becoming more aware of how you can help someone get back on track, as we think about youth of today who don't have the opportunities others have, and understanding the disparity between, again, this is tough to say, the haves and the have-nots. And sometimes this is a race issue, sometimes it's just classism. You can grow up in a context where skin color means nothing. Your parents both went to school, so you're going to be educated. You have no choice. In my context, as I talk about my passion and our mission statement, it's tough. Most youth growing up in bad communities don't have a passion for life. Why is that the case? Survival. I deal with kids who don't know whether their power is going to be turned on when they go home at night from school. And they'll ask, not for money, but for, you know, the dollar meal at McDonald's and I'll buy food. Most of my friends who help out, and these pictures have pictures from what we do. This is tutoring. This is a guy who's an engineer. He's worth a few million. My wife's in the background. And the reality, which is sad, is that when you ask for help, it takes weeks to get help. And so what happens when there's no food, there's no power, there's no water, and that's today. And so my passion is to both feed into my kids, my teens, so they have a passion for life. Challenges, you can have a passion for living, but not a passion for learning. And so what has to happen in a person's life for you to become a lifelong learner? Any idea? Sure. And does that just kind of happen mysteriously and boom, you become somebody who's passionate about ongoing education? No.
No. You understand the connection between education and see it and experience it.
True. And so I'm not saying that education is a panacea or the gospel of the poor. It helps, but it's not everything. Most of the kids I work with that I hope we'll graduate from high school. In our area, the article my friend did, his name is Eugene Scott, you know, said that in Phoenix, less than 50% of black kids will graduate from high school. Teenage pregnancy rate goes huge. In my small group, I have 12, 13, a few Hispanics, but mostly African-American teen moms, whole different story. So unless you become a learner, which doesn't mean that you get straight A's, it means that you desire to improve your life where you're at, then you can become somebody who becomes a leader, who you influence those around you. And this is the pathway to seeing an individual get it, both from the gospel's perspective, which then feeds back into how you choose to live, and then in terms of your family, and then in terms of your community. Where I live, very few have gone to college. So to be the first one in your family to be in college is huge, huge. And so the last thing, and this is a tough one, and I got into a Facebook, LinkedIn argument with my friend Eugene, who'd done an article on Jalil, who's this guy right here, we'll talk about in a minute, about whether it's possible for somebody who has succeeded to choose to come back to the hood and live. And the reality is most that succeed move back to the hood and live there? No. No. And so our discussion was about a friend who's in a PhD program at Harvard who taught in a Chicago school. She's an African-American gal, very gifted. And I kind of tongue-in-cheek just said, the book she's written is amazing, but these guys aren't going to read it. You know, churches in my area aren't going to read it, so what good does it do for the at-risk community that has real needs? And so that began a dialogue where called me a, you know, old white guy that shouldn't be where I was. And I responded back by saying, stop. You know, let's work together and not work against each other. And so this type of dialogue doesn't happen too often because we're afraid to talk about the racist aspect of church and theology to some extent. And so the reality is for my kids to have a heart for their community, I have to live there. people who I choose to have volunteer hopefully will choose to be more around them than away from them. And the sense should be, well, if you only moved over here instead of living there, your life would be so much better. And that's not true. That's not true. But yet that would be the perception. So our passion with Barrio Nuevo is to see kids and teens and young adults discover a passion for life, which is Christ-centered ultimately, to realize in the end that learning is a necessary evil, and then ultimately to become an influencer. And this is a tough one because most of my kids would be influencers for evil, not for good. And so most of my little guys are so smart. They know how to shoplift. They know how to, you know, con you, you know, give you something. And so it's not easy to help them go away from, and this would be a kid thing when I was young, you know, finders keepers, losers weepers. So when you find that iPhone on the ground, God sent that to me. Why can't I have it? Why isn't it mine? So how do you explain to someone that it's not the way it works? What if that was your phone that somebody took? And today the great thing is most smartphones you can't really steal because you can kill them the second they disappear. And so my challenge is it possible for someone who comes out of affluence, education, more normal family, to be capable of interacting in an at-risk context, whether it's refugees, whether it's, you know, Hispanic kids, whether it's black kids that have grown up in poverty. And for the most part, it's a tough question to respond to because most don't do well in that context. So what would be some of the struggles if you have grown up in a, you know, affluent church and all of a sudden somebody asks you to work in a poor neighborhood? What would be some issues that you would have to have some understanding about in order to be able to tutor someone, to be a mentor, to be a big brother, big sister? So how do you explain? When it comes to when somebody's lived in a context where they haven't had anything, to someone who's always had everything. Like I did a presentation 3 weeks ago in a Chinese church that's one of my partners on homelessness, and it could have been about racism. And so mostly teenagers, and they're two older guys, and their response always was, well, why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? And I said, well, what would it be like if I took your identification away from you, no social security, no credit cards, and driver's license, and all your family chooses not to talk to you for the next month, and I dumped you off in downtown Phoenix, how would you live? You know, and he still came back with, well, can't they do this? Can't they do that? And I said, you know, I agree there are certain, you know, governmental assistance programs which I can give sheets out to say, go do this, go do that, but the reality is you wouldn't have a clue. So to have a heart for someone who's in a tough situation isn't always a given in most churches. And so my passion is to work with a few that can go back to their churches and then be a catalyst to help a few, not hundreds, but a few, be willing to drive half an hour to do something outside the box.
And to help them see the entitlement that they have.
Huge.
Do you know the entitlement illustration I just heard that was awesome is, you know, David's the teacher. He says, okay, there's a trash can in front of the room.
Right.
Everybody in the room, ball up a piece of paper, throw it in the trash can. And if you score, you get an extra 20% on the final exam. But you have to stay in your seat. So you're really happy because it's an easy shot for you. But the kid in the back row says, hey, this isn't fair. I'm so far from the trash can. And that's what you know, middle-class white folk don't understand about entitlement is many of us started closer to the trash can, and we think that everybody has a fair shot in America, right? Oh, everybody can go to college. Right. You can be whatever you want, except many people start much farther from the goal, and that's not their fault.
No.
And that's what the suburban mentality tends to think.
I potentially took the seat that you would have gotten.
Yeah.
I know. My fault.
So I say all the time, you know, you didn't choose your skin color. You didn't ask God, can I have the better mom and dad? Or can I have a dad? You didn't select the house you were born into. Those are huge factors which are entitlement. But we don't recognize that for the most part. So a few things I will say to those who help out is, one, are you willing to step back and see your place in what today is still racism, both in society, in the church, and in the church culture? And even more so, classism, which would be if you were to step back, people of the same means relate well together. And it's not necessarily a race thing. But as I study, as I live in my neighborhood, my parents were both from St. Louis, Missouri. So I had many experiences as a kid growing up going into black neighborhoods. And I have relatives who are all churchgoers. But it was my grandma, my mom's mom, who used the N-word for the first time in my life. And my dad came in glued because she basically said, you know, all niggers are bad. And my dad, who grew up in poverty and escaped St. Louis by going into the Air Force, a college grad, read my grandma, you know, what are you doing, you know, and so it was, I was only 6-7 years old, but as I look back at that, I realize that my dad went to a high school that was all white that became all black by the time he graduated from high school in 4 years. His mom lived in a neighborhood that I have this memory of some guy coming up and taking a whiz on their lawn, and they had the dog, nice little collie, looked like Lassie, you know, run out and attack the guy. You know, so I understand, having worked in a downtown church in San Diego, how seniors can be afraid of homeless people because they typically get robbed or hit up for money. That does not mean every person who's older, who has gray hair and a beard, is a bad person. But yet, that would be our perception. Culture is huge. And this, again, is beyond, you know, the parameters of what we're going to talk about. But I relate back to a Chinese church, a Korean church, black churches, Hispanic churches. And every time I go into a different context, I have to put on different, you know, glasses to be able to see through their eyes what they see. Met a new friend probably 3 or 4 months ago, African-American guy, very successful, has a record label, Collision Records. Lecrae, if you know who he is on his label. And he's at a small white downtown church that's brand new, which I'm partnering with, so I bring 20, 30 kids that aren't white to church every week usually. We become friends, and he shares his story, which is a byproduct of the issues of entitlement, racism, or whatever. And he had worked at, Matt Chandler would be somebody who's pretty well known in big church circles, Acts 29 guy, very successful. And the hope of Matt Chandler having this guy come on his staff would be to address the issue of racism and having a church that would be more diverse in its context. And my new friend left after a year because he got fed up with talking and no real action. And so one of the challenges in the church of today is the fact that if you're going to talk about diversity and about multiculturalism, then you need to have church staff, leadership, a reflection of your community. And in most churches, that just is not what happens. And so my prayer is that God will raise up for me, and this other guy, Adam, may be this one person to partner with me to be a better reflection of the community, even though he's got a MDiv from Dallas Seminary. But his experience would not be good news for me because he worked at another white church. Same thing, he walked away after 3 months because he was so fed up with the lack of sensitivity and really an openness, just a dialogue about what are the issues. I live in an area where immigration is huge, and most churches just think it's not a big deal. It's a huge thing. So the biggest obstacle for most people who I have that come and volunteer that aren't college students, that are older, is they really believe that they can fix the life of one of my kids or teens within a short period of time. And it only takes a few weeks for them to realize, one, it's not going to happen. Two, they're going to get, as Chris said previously, very frustrated and be ready to beat somebody up, scream, because their impression of what they thought should happen isn't going to happen. It's one of the most difficult things as a parent, as a pastor, especially as somebody who works in an at-risk situation, is being willing to allow someone to fail in order to succeed. And as a dad with 3 kids that are old now that are all college grads, you know, my kids have gone through a lot of different things. So I know firsthand that failure is just a part of life. But yet most of my friends who want to be involved have great intentions but ultimately fail because they want to impose their standards, their biases in a way that doesn't help. Not everybody's going to be an engineer. Not everybody's going to be, obviously, an attorney or a doctor. So what I did 10 years ago when I got booted out of my church, I'd done Habitat for a decade, and there's a community where I live in South Phoenix called South Ranch 2, which was built now about 17 years ago. because I was the chairman of the board of my affiliate, which was a different area of Phoenix. I had some contact with them. They built this community of 200 homes, and what was unusual for Habitat was they chose to have two of the houses not be occupied by families, but be used as a community center. And the Habitat community in this context was 90% Hispanic. And so as I'm thinking through what I'm going to do, I go back. God says, well, think about what you've been involved with and go back to your context, your networking. And so I go back to a couple friends who are involved with this community and say, what's something that's needed? And as I'm doing this, the individual who had funded the project in 40 acres is what his wife and him donated, and the infrastructure cost, which is a huge amount of money. His wife is the one who wanted to have the two houses built and used for at-risk youth. And so I end up talking to somebody who says, yeah, we've got an executive director who oversees the two houses, but the city's just cut back on their budgeting. There's no after-school programs. And within 6 months, this individual who I relate to is let go because there's no longer, you know, $50,000 a year to donate towards that. It wasn't really a nonprofit, but it was really an extension of another nonprofit. So we end up doing tutoring from ground floor. And so I send an email out, 30 friends, 20 respond and go, would you like to be a part of a new program in a difficult neighborhood to work with kids? And so we did training, and then we handed out flyers, you know, 2 weeks in a row, and then started, had five kids the first time. And over 6 months, that five grew about 20 or 30. Next year, a few more, next year, a few more. Now we have, and my goal and what I'm saying is not to be big, but to be intentionally small, to realize one person, one kid, one team is God's heart for us. And so that's what we've done over the last 8 years. And so tutoring is a huge thing. But the reality is for most kids that come out of tough circumstances, do they want to do homework? Is that a priority in their life? No, never. Do they want to have somebody tell them what they think they need to do? No. But yet over time, what's happened, and we'll look at one or two stories pretty quick-like, is that they catch the notion of having a passion for their life. They catch the notion that when they try harder, better things happen. But the stories they represent, though, are stories which are sad, tragic. But you can't change everything. So you have to be willing to live with tension. I had somebody text me about their ID, whether I still had it after 6 months, and I said, no, you stole from my house. I tossed it in the trash. I got mad at you. So don't text me the day before a job thinking I still have it. And so we do a lot of different things. So I am blessed to have 20 college students that partner with me that get credit. Some others do it for volunteer. And that because of that, we're able to do a lot of different things on a weekly basis. So I am, in a sense, church in the hood, that everything we do is viewed as being church. So we do everything in a sense where people understand this is who we are, this is what we're about. So we do tutoring once a week. We do a life group, mentoring group once a week. We do a teen guy group, girl group that's a soft Bible study. We do a hangout at the park. And one of the things I chose not to do, having been a part of a couple churches that raised lots of money and built a building, was not to do that, but to look at the city as a resource. And most cities have rec centers that are either not used a bunch or not used at all. So I went to the two rec centers in my neighborhood and have partnered with them now for 7-8 years, and it works phenomenally well. This is an old rec center that's huge. The area we use for tutoring is also a senior center during the daytime, so the grandmas that come to that, we bless. In the summertime, I'll take a group of kids, we'll hand out candy, coffee, pastries, but more so just to be with them and love on them in a real way. We also paint their houses. Another rec center is brand new, was named after one of my grandmas in my neighborhood, Faye Gray, and I said to her, this is kind of amazing that you're still alive, and it's named after you. And so one of the part of doing at-risk work is that eventually the kids you work with, the teens you work with, they grow up. And they come to a point where you actually see success. And success isn't straight A. Success is finishing something. And so job resourcing is huge. So I'm not going to talk about this. I'm going to come back to this. But I'm going to look at the lives of a couple kids to give you a sense of what it would be like if you woke up and you weren't the skin color you have and you were something different. Monique Savage is this gal in the middle. She's 18, just graduated from high school. I've known her the longest out of any of my kids, so 9 years. She's one of the more fortunate kids in my group. Most of our families move every year. Who knows what Section 8 housing is? Anybody? Okay, what's Section 8 housing? And so you have to go through a process where you're screened, you're qualified, and you get the house, and you have probably, I think, once a quarter visits from a social worker or caseworker who makes sure the house is up and up. Most in my neighborhood that live in Section 8 housing don't live in what would be perceived as poor houses. They're newer houses, 10 years old or less. And so the perception of most of my volunteers when they take a kid home, if they do, this kid lives in a nice house, and I'll say, they do. But you have to understand the mom that has the house has no means to pay for the utilities in the summertime when it's 110 out. So Monique is the only kid in my group who's lived in the same house the last 14 years. Her mom, Tanisha, is a pothead, has had 3 boyfriends since I've known her, and they're all the abusive type, and the one right now lives in her neighborhood, in fact, lives across the street. Momo is someone who has done things right, but has 2 older siblings, an older brother and an older sister. The older brother, not married, but has 3 kids, and is trying to do it right. He has a police record, so it's not as easy to get jobs to kind of follow through. Her other sibling, Alexis, is 20, has cerebral palsy, has issues with one hand, one eye doesn't work. So she has some challenges, and so she's not the easiest person to work with. A lot of attitude, a lot of venom that comes out a lot of times. But even though she's done things which have hurt me and pushed my button, I still allow her to ask for stuff. So right now she has a new job. She's going through training. And I told her I'd help her with the fee for her CPR class if she could get half the money herself. And she did. So I gave her the $20 to pay for the other half. What's amazing about Momo, in spite of all the chaos, all the craziness that she's lived around, is she's done well in school. And so very few of my teens have taken calculus in high school. How many of you guys took calc in high school? Anybody? A few? Okay. So a few. But what's amazing with Momo, though, is that she's somebody who cares and has a heart. And she's a byproduct of what we've been about for almost 10 years. So she'd be someone who is not a superstar because she's not going to go to Harvard, but she's somebody who chooses to follow through and she cares, which is amazing, both for the little kid who's a juvenile delinquent for the most part, but also for an older teen type who is out of it and lost. And so a couple questions to step back and realize, even in Momo's tough situation, what's enabled her to succeed is the fact that she's had a few people walk with her the whole time. Without those people, most likely she wouldn't have graduated. She'd be pregnant. She's got, I don't know, 5 friends who have kids now. That's very common in the black community where I live. It's almost like a you show off. So she has one mutual friend that has not one, not two, but 3 little guys. And, you know, Ashley is 17. Her mom had her when she was 15. And so what encourages me about Momo is the fact right now she works at Walmart, and that laptop in front of her wasn't a gift from somebody. She actually paid for it with her own money. Huge.
I just want to say she is a superstar. I just not correcting you. Like you said, she's not a superstar. She doesn't go to Harvard.
But. Yeah, no, I'm just joking.
I know.
But I actually have another gal who's a year older than her who could have gone to Harvard. So this is kind of a funny story. Sure. She could be you. I don't have her picture up. Yeah. No, just kidding. No, Momo's in a program, which I'll talk about for a minute, that's called Europe, which is based in the East Coast. It's not Christian, but it's corporately driven, but it's very easy to be used by the church. And so I'm somebody that says you can learn. God speaks the truth through different means, and sometimes it's through means which we don't necessarily want to admit to. And so Europe is a program that has been inspired by corporate America to put the means for at-risk youth that have aged out, 18, 24, to have an opportunity to do college for a year, get some training with life skills, which are huge. So Momo and Jalil right here and Dominique I'll talk about are all in the same program. What's amazing is they have to dress for success to go to school. And it's not that they said you've got to go out and spend money. They provided the means for them to have clothes. So one of the first things I learned is you got to come on time. Nobody does anything on time. You have a Hispanic, manana, manana. You have black, maybe like 3 hours later than what we talked about, I'll show up. They get paid a little bit for going to school for the first semester. They're taking basically equivalent of 15 units. And at the end of the semester, they're on a track. Either they're going to work in a Bank of America, Chase Bank, or American Express, or if you're a geek in a IT context for 6 months, where they'll get paid $600 a month. And then when they finish next August, the guarantee is if they finish the program, 90% do, that the company they're at, if they want a job, will hire them for at least $15 an hour. Minimum wage in Arizona is $8 an hour. Very few of their siblings or parents make more than $10 an hour. And I don't know about you, but to live on $9 or $10 an hour is almost impossible if you have a family of one or two. And so Momo is doing phenomenally well. And so the question I go back to, my friend that wrote the article would give a sense that she should be a statistic, not a superstar, because she has stayed in, chosen to finish, and for the most part, she's got the smile on her face, which she has most of the time. Most of the kids around her don't look like that, though. So, simple question. So if you had met Monique when I did 9 years ago, her sister was pretty foul. Most kids I work with, when I have a new volunteer, they will test them to the hilt. And what that means is if you're a white young gal, which you are, they'll you know, F you a few times, they'll say some racial slurs, they'll send you, if they get your phone number, you know, a text message that's pretty, you know, off. And so the question is, are you willing to accept that for a short time as they test you to see if you really want to be a part of their life? And I've had some volunteers who are just overwhelmed with the stuff, others who get it and within a short time become connected in a way that's just incredible. It's tough to get volunteers to come and be consistent in this context. So it's not easy. So I have some superstar moms and dads who've been involved for a long time that love what they do and have adopted kids in a way that really makes Momo's life happen. And this is not to brag about me, but about my volunteers. If we had not been involved in her life, she would not be in the program she is right now. Dominique, who is the gal next to Momo, next to Jalil, is also 18. One of the things that we do, which is kind of a part of our lives now, is paint houses of low-income seniors. And so a lot of the kids we have are a byproduct of painting Grandma's house. And so Damo I met 6 years ago. We painted Grandma Pearl or Maggie's house. And Grandma, 82, wheelchair, on oxygen, dying of renal failure. Had to go in for dialysis 4 times a week. Damo's mom, Audricia, lived with mom, take care of her. She has 2 siblings, actually 3, 2 sisters and a brother, who pretty much chose not to help out at all. And so as Grandma was dying, she asked me to help out. She said she had some financial issues, and I said, oh, sure, I have a couple older friends who we went together, went to her bank, and had discovered that her granddaughter had figured out a way to steal from her. And this is very common in an at-risk context and also in a affluent context, too. And so what happened was the granddaughter asked Grandma, well, would you mind cashing a refund check from tax time? Because my friends don't have an account. And so Grandma said, sure. And what Grandma did was she signed on the back of a check for $6,000 with somebody else scribbled on it in her account. Next day, the granddaughter says, Grandma, can you go and, you know, withdraw the $6,000? And Grandma does that, not understanding that no bank is going to allow you to deposit a second-party check in an ATM and have it actually go through. And so a week later, Wells Fargo, which is my bank too, calls her up and says, we can't clear the check. So the money that you took out now is, you know, in the rears. And so all of a sudden, and Molly lives on Social Security, nothing else. So all the checks she'd written a few weeks before for everything, little mortgage, everything else had bounced. So all of a sudden she's like $2,000 or $3,000 in the hole on top of the $6,000. So I intervene, make a long story short, with a good friend who we go to the bank, and the bank, which amazed me, closed the account out. My one friend helped catch her up, and then I talked to the granddaughter and to the sister about what had happened. They go, what right do you have to say anything? And I said, as I look at her bank records, this is fraud. And if you hadn't been as smart as you were, if you had signed on this and grandma had signed on this, you know, I would have you in court, because grandma signed on it. There's no proof of anything of your involvement, which was unfortunate. And so the neat news for Molly before she dies is Wells Fargo chose not to go after her for the $6,000. Week after this happens with Wells Fargo, she gets a notice from the IRS about the same check which Wells Fargo had gotten from the IRS, that it was a stolen check. And what this means is that the person who had done the check had reported to the IRS that it was stolen, which means they got another check for the $6,000, and this $6,000 they also pocketed, so they end up with $12,000. So back to the real story. So what happened is that Odresia, and I told her, I said, you got to talk to your mom. And this is where influence, being a part of a community, you know, pays off. I said, you've got to make sure your mom decides if she's going to give you the house or whether it's going to be a fight amongst four people when mom passes in a short time. So the good news was that mom, with some advice and counsel from a couple friends, signed over the house really quick, and the house was put in Odresia's name. At the funeral, and this is a sad story, the two other siblings stood up and basically blasted Odresia for getting the house. Like, how could you do this? You know, it's our house. So out of all this mess, Odresia's three kids become a part of my life pretty much like a month after we painted the house 6 years ago. And so Damonique is a gal who graduated from high school, same high school as Momo, and has been a part of her mom's life. And in most at-risk community settings, when you're a single mom, you tend to be isolated. You tend to be afraid of everybody because you've always gotten hurt. And so Damo, much like her mom, was someone that chose to hide most of the time. And so because of those that are involved with her over the last 3-4 years, she's become somebody who's very much more outwardly focused. But without that involvement, without that relationship focus, which is the key to life transformation. So when you talk about the gospel, you've got to talk about the fact that you're not going to share Christ with someone unless you really get to know them, typically. And I'm an old Jesus freak who would have said, hey, you know, I shared Christ with 5 people, you know, this last week. But the reality is, no. Until I walk with them and watch them, they watch me, not much is going to happen. So as I've watched Damo grow a little bit over the last 3 or 4 years, it's been really tough because her mom hasn't had a job for a decade. And so one of the difficulties in poor neighborhoods with moms who either have some type of police background record or have never worked, what do you do when all of a sudden you've been told Damo got a job 6 months ago and all of a sudden the food stamps for her family are cut totally? She went from getting $500 a month to getting $67 a month. So back to how do you decide who to help, who not to help? It's tough. I don't have a big church next to me that will write a check for $1,000 easily. So I told Odresia, I said, the best thing I can do for you is to walk with you and help you get a job. So job resourcing is a huge part of what we do. Volunteers are huge. So I have some friends who have helped out with helping find jobs for both teens and for adults. Odresia is not a kid, she's 37. And so one of the amazing stories with Damo is as she finishes her college degree, she also gets her high school degree, she gets a job with Momo at Walmart, and both end up choosing to be a part of this Year Up program for this coming year to figure life out, to have the potential of having a better job at this point. Story with the mom, though, which is neat, was my wife is a chaplain, has worked at a hospital the last couple of years and gotten to know staff that do house cleaning. And so you make $11 an hour as a house cleaner at Banner University Hospital. And so Damo's mom, Odresia, has been working 4 days. And so she's not worked in 10 years. And so the amazing story with this is that all of a sudden she goes from a mom who doesn't have much to a mom now who has potential, hope, and she is one of my superstar moms at this point. It's not easy to be in a cycle where you've been raised in generational poverty and break out of it. Tough. Last story, Jalil, who's 18. Jalil is a, see if I can say this in a funny way. Jalil's like 6'2", 280, 270, very happy-go-lucky guy. Because he's gotten SSI, you guys know what that is. His mom died when he was 5, and so from that point on, he's received $700 a month, lived with a great-grandma who's taken most of that money. But he loves his iPhone 6 Plus, and he's always on Snapchat, parading around, taking pictures of everything. He's very much in love, more so with his, I don't own any shoes that cost $300, but if you've ever been around guys that are into either Jordans, Nikes that come out, you know, big bucks. And right now, because of Back to the Future, you're going to have these shoes that tie themselves. The laces buckle up. So it's a little story to make it more interesting. His mom died when he was 5. She was a crackhead. He doesn't know that. When he turned 16, I've been around him for 2 years. We painted his grandma's house. Is how we met him. He chose to drop out of high school. Not a smart guy. Struggles. He'd say, I just don't learn like everybody else. And he doesn't. And so one of the disparities in today's educational system is that it's really not geared towards kids that come out of poverty. Most don't have learning disabilities. They just don't learn like everybody else does. And so he gave up. And so he figured out, well, if I drop out of school and I'm 16, grandma can't force me to do anything. And that's true. State of Arizona, once you turn 16, do what you want to. Even if he was 15 or 14, they don't really do much in following up. And so he drops out of high school. And grandma, I know a little bit. He has a godmom, amazing story. Terry is a white gal in her late 50s, early 60s, who's a nurse. And she actually was with Jalil's mom as she was giving birth to him and met her probably when she was 3-4 months pregnant, because she was a druggie. It was a high-risk thing, so Terry's thing was that. And so she actually was a part of Jalil's life from day one. And so Terry's goal wasn't to rescue him. She would just take him out once a week as he grew up for food and just talk. And so I got to know Terry when Jalil dropped out. So we all went to his high school, you know, got the bad news, the fact that just because he turned 16, he wanted to drop out. The fact was he was going to be kicked out because his prior semester he'd missed 80% of his classes, which grandma didn't know. And so here's a scenario. If Jalil hadn't had two of my friends walk with him for the next 2 years, he would be a statistic. Either drug overdose, somebody who suffers from depression. And the difficulty, if you were to meet him, he's a very happy-go-lucky guy. But most kids that come out of real poverty, real hardship, struggle. And they should. I struggle with back to the principles that CCD promotes when it comes to having a sense of self-worth and value. If you don't have that, and he's grown up around the church, but still doesn't have any sense that he's God's, you know, gift to his grandma, gift to me, that God made him with a special purpose. So as he's going through this issue of what do I do, where do I go, he realizes you can't get a job without a high school diploma. You can't get a job without any prior experience. And so he's frustrated. He doesn't know what to do. And so younger white guy, 30-something, Matt, walks with him for a little bit, has a friend who works at a school that's for behavioral and remedial students. That's a special high school. In Arizona, we have charter schools. So Jalil becomes a part of this school. The challenge for Jalil, though, is he's the type to miss school, and the bus ride to get to his school is almost an hour drive. He chose, on his own, to go at 7 in the morning. There's a likelihood of him getting up at 5, being on the bus by 6, is almost zero. But for the last 2 years, Jalil's done that. Jalil graduated from high school in June. Huge story. That would not have happened between Matt's input in his life, another friend, Victor, who's my age, who's retired, whose grandson he adopted quite a while ago. And he got Jalil involved with his son's private school's football team. And Jalil played football for 2 years. Jalil right now, an amazing story, this is not the Jalil I knew a year ago, is going to the Europe program, but he's also working part-time at the hospital as a house cleaner. And he's somebody who'd say, I don't want to do that, that's beneath me. And all of a sudden now, he loves what he does. So back to the real story, which is the bigger picture. What if the church chooses not to have a heart for the communities that have been forgotten? Yeah. And so I'm the bad guy because I still think we within the PCA have so far to go when it comes to wanting to do something that's really tangible. And my bragging isn't about me. It's about Jalil. It's about Momo. It's about Damo. The fact that they're not going to be a statistic. The fact that they're going to be my influencers in a couple years. They already are.
What does biblical discipleship look like in these stories?
That's a tough question. It's not like what it would look like in your church.
It's
relationship driven. I have a variety of college students, all varieties in terms of where they're from. Very few are from Phoenix. And so most of what we do is one-on-one. And so for Jalil, what's happened, I do a guys group once a week that he's been a part of for 3-4 years. And within that group, there are 4 other guys that feed back into the guys that are involved. And we talk about life stuff from a biblical perspective. So it's not, let's turn to, you know, James. It is, but it's different. The challenge, and this is where it is tough, you know, Hispanic community, you have to speak Spanish for the most part to relate back to the families that are involved. And so you have to understand his context, his language, which is not my language. And so as he's struggled, and he's done some bad stuff, which he's admitted to more to my wife than to me, that he has fears that he's going to die. He gets some anxiety attacks. And so as he's learned a little bit through a couple friends, mentors at this point, to pray for God's peace, to pray for God's presence as he struggles with sexual addiction, pornography, very common things within our youth culture today, especially in at-risk context where phones are easy to get, internet's easy to get. The difficulty, it's not really a difficulty, it's more the journey with me is I'm his dad. He doesn't like me sometimes because I speak the truth. He gets mad at me, I get mad at him. I'll go, you have to follow through. So if you choose not to go to school, don't sleep in my couch. You're out. He was hurt. His grandma kicked him out of the house when he turned 18. You know, she goes to church. She's somebody who'd be considered a godly example. So discipleship in this context comes back to, are you willing to walk with me as I struggle? He's been with his cousin for the last 2 months. She's kicking him out next week. He'll be back at my house for a short time. When it comes to, and this is where my situation is very different from yours or most churches, a lot of the kids I have go to churches that are part of their culture. And so my point isn't leave your church. My point is discover on your own your spiritual identity. And this is where it's really not easy because I have a lot of Hispanic kids that are Catholic. Not really, but their parents are. A lot of kids that are Pentecostal Hispanics, and they're not Pentecostal, but their parents are. And so the hope is, as we walk together over time, that they see the example of the adults that are Christians, the college students that are Christians, and come to a point where they see what's been missing. And so the difficulty is, I'd love to say we're going to sit down and have this hardcore Bible study. That is me, but isn't me now. And what I've discovered is that Jesus was very simple in his teaching methodology. Paul's a different story, but Jesus was a people person who saw real needs and spoke in the vernacular of the people. And that's what we do, you know, all the time. Everything we do has some type of illustrative picture behind it. So good question. If you were to ask my kids, teens, what we do, they'd say everything we do is church. So from their perspective, this is what you just said. From those on the outside coming in, their first thing is to say what you just said. Well, why don't we do a Bible study? I say, it'd be fine, but you wouldn't last more than a week or two because you got to play basketball first and then sit down and do this because they're not going to listen to you, you know, too long.
You make it part of natural life rather than this artificial thing that's inside.
Right. What's tough, though, like when we do tutoring, none of the kids have homework, so how can you do tutoring? You know, so I'll say, if you're going to come, you're going to do math fact sheets and reading for a half an hour. Otherwise, don't come. So they'll come, and they'll bellyache, moan, and groan, but they do it. Then we'll go play basketball because the community center we meet at also has a gym. So, again, it's not easy. Part of the journey, which, again, is difficult for those that come out of normal family settings, is there's no nuclear family. So you become that. And that's the exciting part of this. It's very rewarding. But also the downside is kids, teens, adults crash and burn. And so are you willing to spend the time to feed back into them the gospel in a way that's much broader than just a confession of faith? And that's where I struggle with so many Reformed Christians who have this paradigm box that's so small. that really doesn't have anything to do. None of the kids I have ever been really involved in a liturgical church. So to walk into a liturgical church, which we're doing right now, like, shoom. And so it's not easy. So the songs you sing, whoever preaches, the examples you use, the music you sing, how you pray, are so different. So different. And we attend black churches, Hispanic churches. And so I've been raised in a context where when church goes beyond an hour, people are looking at their watch. You know, what are you doing? Where are you going? Whereas in these contexts, you can have church for the whole day. It doesn't stop. So back to what I'm doing, questions, comments as we finish.
Is there any worship element to what you do?
Yes. Tuesday nights, we have what would be considered soft church, where we do singing for 10, 15 minutes. I'll have somebody within my group, not myself usually, share their story with a very simple biblical message. That's church to my kids. We're also a part of another church that we go to at night. We've done church in the past, and I decided to stop being Superman and trying to do everything. And so one of the difficulties for me to do church the right way, my prayer is that God would bring to me some leaders within the African-American church community and the Hispanic community to work together, and that's slowly starting to happen. So what will happen for me is we'll do a once-a-month worship time that's really multicultural. That's very difficult to do. There are very few churches in any big city that really have a diverse congregation. We're homogeneous, this and that. But very important element, though, and the difficulty is most kids that come out of this context don't fit in your typical church. So they're not going to sit still and behave like little statues for more than 10 minutes. So it's a journey. And so we struggle with that, but we're still in the process of figuring it out. So we do church once a week with another PCA church. It's brand new. I'm kind of the mentor to the young pastor who's the church planner. So I said, do you want to have 20, 30 kids come each week that don't look like everybody else? And are you going to think through how you... And I've been pretty mean on him. I said, you got to at least have one song that has life in it, that you clap your hands and has meaning. Not this, you know, drab, sorrowful, you know, whatever. So, yeah, turn the light on. No, thanks.
So what do you think that looks like, guys? Something I've been struggling through is the, like, teen moms and a lot of the people that I have in my life and in my church. And, I mean, they've come to church with me before, but I'm like, this is not a place that they're going to stick around. And that is, like, driving me nuts.
See.
I don't, like, what do you think the answer to that is? Shame or Sunday?
There's no answer to that question. So the good news is that there's three different sheets. Is it one, you're involved? Two, you become the link to them for church. And so it's not that your church is going to become significant enough to them. And so the bigger picture is, what other churches are out there that you could choose to go to that would be more similar to them? Which sheet are you looking for? There's a CCD sheet, and there's also a youth sheet, or the two. Yeah, right, it doesn't. Yeah, the other sheet, there's one that would be, maybe I didn't hand, this is one, and then the youth sheet is right here. Yeah,
thank you.
So when your kids go to your church, what happens?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're just kind of bored.
No, it's true. They're totally bored out of their mind.
We have a church in yeah, I was just going to say, we have a church, a PCA church in New Orleans that is really diverse, and we have at-risk youth, we have teenage moms, and we have a classic liturgy, and I think we have, like, found a balance where different types of folks, including people that are looking for what you get at a normal PCA church, and young kids can come in to be engaged. Like, we mix up the worship. And I think the sermon, you know, a lot of kids are tuning out for 30-minute sermons, but...
Most adults tune out, so it's not that unusual,
yeah,
be real. Yeah.
Enough amens.
Yeah. But I would say in the PCA, there are very few churches that would be that way. Yeah. So.
Coming from a historically black, from a black church background, when I first started attending like a Reformed church, it's like, this is so weird. So I'm going to try and show up right after all this weird singing and all this
right
before the sermon and leave right after the sermon.
Right.
Because the sermon was just rich and good, and I developed an appetite for what I was being fed in the sermon. But I went to my church for the worship and the praise because that was not weird and it was normal.
Yeah.
And now, in just helping my church think through how we can not be such a white church because the congregation is not white. And I love our hymns, but it is not reflective of the congregation. So I encourage people who are curious to go and visit a black church. I can give you three or four, and you'll see so many differences, and that's what we can incorporate. Like, polytonality could be in our music. That's an Africanism. And the black people in the congregation feel a lot more at home. If we had some rhythm, some drums, some rhythmic diplomacy, you would have black people in the congregation swaying and clapping, and it would feel a little bit more familiar. So there are just kind of little things that, like, my church family just doesn't know to be aware of. But if you just ask, or if people like me become parts of the church, and now I'm on the praise team, or I'm greeting, or I'm, you know, involved in this family, then I'll say, well, here, I think that we should have drums. Because that's what I'm used to. And
see, it's... You're an outgoing person, so it's very difficult, though, to walk into an established church and challenge everything you just said. The likelihood you're going to be ignored, you know, back to the no, you know.
Ask. So what do you think?
Instead of you assist and say,
yeah.
Maybe you actually create, like, a diverse church in the first place.
Yeah. So you have to be intentional to begin with. So,
yeah.
So my two cents would be, it's better to start new and afresh with that DNA from the get-go, but it's very difficult as a PCA white guy to do that unless you already live there, and it takes years to build relationships where somebody else will trust you enough to say, I want to work with you. So my two cents is, we choose to do church at night so others can go to church in the morning, so you can, you know, have your own sense of worship community. Difficulty, though, is that in the black churches, my kids don't fit because they're not welcome, because they're the, you know, bad kids that have been pushed out. So you still have this struggle, which is real. I'm going to hand out my business cards. Please email me. I'd love to hear more about what you're doing. So in your situation, you know, move to where he lives. You know, it's not...
Well, and no, you're right. We do still have, like, flexibility. But I think it's just hard because there are certain people that feel really strongly about certain aspects of the worship. I don't know.
Everybody feels things strong about worship.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to talk about two, three hot topics in the PCA, worship's number one. Women in ministry would be number two. And then to have what I'm doing doesn't fit. So back to what you're involved with is very much outside the box. It's one thing to talk about doing mercy work, and I don't like this, in a diaconal context, because to me, the church is word, sacrament, and deed, those three together. That'd be a Kellerism. You have a stool with three legs, not two. But yet we act as if it's a two-leg stool. And so most of my friends are totally, you know, sacramentalists to the nth degree. So what I do doesn't fit at all. So we argue and fight a little bit. We don't now. So be like her and ask the right questions, but come up with doable suggestions. Like, here are five songs we could sing that have, like, today we sang a few songs, which I'm going to show to my one friend who has some way of not seeing there's so much more out there. And it's not just that it's a black song that's gospel, but it's also a Hispanic song. It's more, do you have any sense of the fact that your songs aren't singable? So when you walk in, it's a performer. It's not the group singing, which is sad. Real question, though, is whether your friends within the church that are kind of more like acquaintances want what you're doing, or is it more you're an outside factor that you're going to bring something which isn't really welcomed? Because that's part of the tension. And so for me, you know, I had to help two or three in the church were attending realize you're not going to fix these kids, you know, so don't have that be your goal. If it is, then I'm not going to come anymore. Get to know them, learn their names, and then do something. So Other questions? Otherwise, we'll wrap up. So let me say a prayer. No, thanks for coming. Email me. I'd love to hear your stories and share a little bit more about doing at-risk work. Lord, thanks for your love and for the fact that you've raised up such an amazing body of Christ that's very diverse, very different. And I pray, God, that you'd help us, especially as white guys that think we know everything, to see the world is so much bigger and different than we are. And I thank you for this conference, for a chance to be a part of it, and more so for how you're working in the lives of so many different people who you've brought to a point where they see the need to talk about racial reconciliation, the need to talk about working in an at-risk context and not pretending that everything's okay when it's not. Father, bless the rest of today and the rest of the conference this evening and tomorrow. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.